Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden.
The Vatican Press Corps is full of very interesting and gifted people. They're journalists who are accredited and gathered together to exercise a role of an audience when announcements are made, and from time to time to ask some interesting questions. One of them is the American journalist Diane Montagna. She's accredited to the Holy See as a journalist there. She's co-founder of collegeofcardinalsreport.com, co-author of Christus Victor 2019, and Calming the Storm, Emmaus Press 2022. But Diane has sprung to public consciousness and some degree of fame by being the journalist who got the scoop that told us the truth about Pope Francis and the Latin Mass. We had been told, without sufficient evidence, that Pope Francis had consulted all the bishops and a variety of other people across the world, and that having brought together all the evidence, was inevitably forced to withdraw the Latin Mass from the Catholic Church. But it turned out that the documentary evidence said something rather different, and in a quite extraordinary way, Diane got hold of it. So to give you the opportunity of hearing how this scoop of the century took place, and to introduce you to Diane, I'm absolutely delighted to say that she joins me now. Diane, thank you very much for being here. At least you're here with your voice. We've got video problems, but that doesn't matter. I'm so pleased to talk to you because I've wanted to have this conversation for a long time, and you really are something of an expert as the Vatican correspondent, and you have broken news recently of the kind that every religious journalist just longs for. So I'll ask you about that later on. But first of all, thank you for coming. How did a nice American girl like you end up with a glamorous job as a Vatican correspondent? I know you went via Austria. Can you tell us, please, what happened to you?
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you, Gavin, for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be here with you. And, well, how did I get to Rome? I had a background I had studied Italian as an undergraduate some years ago and spent time in year abroad in Florence. And, you know, I was in the U.S. at the time. I was doing some translation work, translating for Zenit News Agency. The addresses, this would have been in the pontificate of Benedict XVI. And I was translating his Wednesday audiences. It happened to be his Wednesday audiences on prayer. And one day I got a message from my editor, and she said to Diane, a position at the Osservatore Romano has just opened up for a translator. You need to apply. And I had no aspirations, no ambitions to come back to Rome or to work in the Vatican. But I applied and I got it. And I came over for a year and worked as a translator for the English edition of the Osservatore Romano. And then from there, I moved into journalism. Now, as Providence would have it, I guess I had a good background to do that work because I had studied Italian. And also, as you mentioned, I had done some graduate studies at the International Theological Institute in Gaming, Austria. Beautiful, beautiful place. The campus has since moved, but Franciscan University keeps its campus there. And at the time that I was there, the International Theological Institute also had a presence there. And it was just probably the happiest years of my time, of my life, an extraordinary time. The curriculum was... it was a great books program based on the fathers and doctors of the church, very strong presence of St. Thomas, and the community life was just extraordinary, as well as the liturgical life. Because the International Theological Institute had been founded in part to help rebuild the church in Eastern Europe after the fall of communism, they gave a lot of scholarships to Eastern Europeans, Byzantine Catholics for the most part. Some would have been married clergy, others young students, and they all came there to Gaming. And for some of them, it was the first time in their life that they could openly practice their faith. And so with their presence, we had daily liturgy, divine liturgy in various languages, whether it was Old Slavonic or Ukrainian or Romanian, sometimes in English. So we had their presence, which was really extraordinary, as well as all of the gifts and the gift of hospitality that they brought. It was a real, for, you know, someone raised in the United States, it was such a tremendous gift to live with them. There were also many families around. The professors lived very close with their families, lots of children. So it was a little slice of heaven on earth, about as close as you can get between the liturgical life, the life of the academic life, and the life of study, and the families and presence of children, as well as just an extraordinarily beautiful natural setting. So after that, I went to Italy for a couple of years, improved my Italian a bit more, eventually went back to the US, and then came this offer to work in the Vatican, where I spent a year, and then, as I said before, moved into journalism. So that's about it.
Well, it's a very exciting journey. And how do you enjoy living in Rome?
It's a love-hate relationship, I would say. You know, people will think this is very, very glamorous. And I mean, it is extraordinarily beautiful. It's one undoubtedly, and it should be one of the most beautiful cities in the world. But, you know, it's Italy. So fortunately, I have I have quite a bit of Italian blood, which helps one to sort of understand the dynamics and navigate one's way. But yes, it's beautiful and it's extraordinary to live here. So yes, on the whole, a great gift.
I was once exploring being the Anglican chaplain in Florence, which involved having a church which was half an opera centre and half a liturgical centre in part of Machiavelli's palace. But the church was funded by about seven flats it owned, and you had to be a proficient in Italian landlaw in order to deal with it and manage recalcitrant Italian tenants. And there were a few other reasons, but you have to be able to enjoy Italian culture, the ups and the downs of it, don't you, if you're going
yes.
to live in Italy?
And the bureaucracy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, congratulations for doing it. People are going to want to know what your take on Pope Leo is. We're all just sitting here with bated breath. It's been an extraordinary few weeks, 100 days, effectively. And all the commentators are getting themselves in an enormous state of excitement, and everyone is claiming Leo for his own. He hasn't yet, fortunately, invited Father James Martin in to sign his latest book on the flyleaf, or sent him a BA do with kisses at the bottom. But short of that, it's interesting the way that both sides have got two reactions. The optimists are saying, he's one of ours. Look at the signs. It's fantastic. And the paranoid on each side are saying, no, he's going to be, if you're conservative, he's going to be Francis II. If you're a radical, he's going to be Benedict XVII. There's a kind of group madness going on. What's your take on what we might expect, given, and this is a really unfair thing to ask you, because we're going to find out in a few days when he works his way through the dicasteries. And above all, will Tuccio keep his job?
Will Tuccio keep his job indeed? well, what is my take? My take is that perhaps he belongs to neither. If we want to talk about sides, perhaps he belongs to neither side. I think he is seeking to belong to the Lord above all. You know, when he came out onto the loggia.
But that's our side.
Well,
no,
yes.
Just joking.
Yes,
I mean, that was so pious, and I ruined it. I'm really sorry. Anyway, back to your balanced intellectual and diplomatic piety. He belongs to the Lord, as a pope should. I'm sorry, well, Anthony. Go ahead.
As a pope should, but as not all popes do, or have, as history tells us throughout the centuries. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, my take. I am. If you would have asked me a month ago or 6 weeks ago, I would have said I'm cautiously optimistic. I would say now that I am optimistic. I do think I'm optimistic, though I think that he has some very, very serious challenges to face. We can all see that's somewhat obvious. But if, the courage and the fortitude that are going and the prudence that are going to be required to navigate through these things is quite considerable. So yes, but I would say that I am optimistic about things. You know, when he came out onto the loggia on May 8th, his first words were, you know, peace be with you. And he said, you know, these are the words of our risen Lord, the good shepherd who laid his life down for his sheep. And he said, so I think that, well, the following day, you know, he gave a homily in the Sistine Chapel during Mass with all of the cardinals. And there again, you know, he gave a very Christ-centered homily. He spoke at the end about, you know, quoting St. Ignatius of Antioch, you know, who's going to be given, you know, to wild beasts for the sake of the Lord. And there, you know, again, his words seemed genuinely very focused on the Lord. And he seems to be a man who wants to conform himself. I would say a reserved. Some people will find him boring, actually, because he's rather calm and reserved. But I find that like fresh spring water.
A bit of a relief. Yes, that's right. We could do with boring, couldn't we, after not having been at all bored for a long time.
Yes, and he does seem to be, you know, he does seem by his actions, small things that not everyone will notice. He does seem to really be seeking, since the beginning, to conform himself to the office of Peter. And yes, so I'm quite hopeful. And I think that there have also been signs, considerable signs, that while, you know, he also mentioned Pope Francis, he mentioned synodality from the loggia. And so that for some people will be a great cause of concern, naturally. But I think he may Catholicize some of the things. I think he is a man. Someone described to me last week, they said, you know, he's what is the line from the scriptures? You'll know it better than I. A bruised reed he will not break. What is the?
Yes.
Yeah, what's the form?
Yes, Isaiah. A stuttering wick he will not quash out.
Yes, that he seems to have that sort of temperament and yeah. Personality. So he's not going to come down hard on anyone, and he's going to try to maintain peace. I do think that there are signs that can give us hope for what's going to be happening.
I had a great, thank you. I think that's very helpful. I had a great sense that he's really a very astute diplomat. And so when he began to talk about Francis appreciatively and synodality, my take was, well, this is what a diplomat would do. He will give signs to everybody that he's at least cognizant of what the issues are, and we'll take them as they are and then try and bring the best out of them. So I thought when he started talking about synodality and my friends all freaked out and pulled what remains of their hair right out of their heads and said, this is it, we're finished forever. I said, well, he's yet to define synodality. I mean, there are ways, as some of us have been saying for a while, that synodality could be a gift to the church if you express it in a Catholic way. I thought, what else could he do but pay tribute to his predecessor, unless he was going to undermine the integrity of the office by you know, bickering? I mean, that would be awful. So I'm sure you're right. It seems to me he's a man of some profundity and maturity. All his words and spirituality ring true, and they have kind of had a depth to them.
Well, also to your point, Gavin, also to your point, you know, we shouldn't forget that he was the head of the Augustinian order for 13 years, I believe, from 2000 or 2001 until 2013. And so, you know, there was an interview with Il Messaggero before he went to Castel Gandolfo this summer, which we can talk about that. I think that's another absolutely wonderful sign. But this Augustinian prior said that he received a 10-minute round of applause when he had finished his term. Now, a man who's successful in governing, you know, this is an international order of Augustinian men. He must have quite a bit of experience of dealing with men of different outlooks, different persuasions. and to be able to navigate that. So, and that's a real exercise in diplomacy. And he just seems to be the sort of man that is not going to want to crush the legacy of his predecessors, or appear to be crushing the legacy of his predecessors. And he also seems to be someone who's able to see the good. So someone who's going to highlight where he can, or what he believes is the good that Pope Francis has done. But at the same time, he is now the successor of St. Peter. And I think he seems to have definite ideas, some of which may go against the sort of tone that we've grown accustomed to over the past 12 years.
So let me role play and present my own inner neurotic to you and say, yes, that every day that I've woken up since he has become Pope, I've said, Lord, let this be the day when the Latin Mass is brought back to us. Lord, let this be the day.
Yes.
And all the things that we've talked about so far, I can wait for him to get round the dicasteries and ask Tucho about his publishing history. I'm in no huge hurry. I think it'll be fine. But when I hear some of the latest appointments under Pope Francis, taking what seems to me to be revenge against the faithful unnecessarily in Charlotte, for example.
Or Detroit.
Or Detroit, exactly. Then part of me says, no, I can't wait anymore. Enough of this studied, mature diplomatic ambivalence. Act, please. Why hasn't he acted?
Well, he hasn't acted. I don't think we can I don't think it's reasonable that for us to expect that he's going to act quite yet. It is this, first of all, a very practical reason. These are the summer months in Italy, and people are on holiday. And I think he did, as he himself stated, he wanted to take time to go to Castel Gandolfo, which I think is a wonderful thing. The fact that, you know, he goes on holiday, he's made four Marian, we haven't touched on, but you know, he's made four Marian pilgrimages since he was elected. The first was to Our Lady of Good Counsel in Genazzano. It's about an hour and a half outside of Rome. It's run by Augustinians. He went there, I believe it was just 2 days after his election. And then to end his time at Castel Gandolfo earlier this week, he went to another Marian pilgrimage that was one of the favorites of John Paul II. So that's just another element to set the stage. But he wanted to take that time in Castel Gandolfo in order to pray and reflect. I mean, one can't really imagine what it's like to be Pope. But, you know, after the election, between May 9th and when he went to Castel Gandolfo, he was very much accustoming himself to a new role and to the rhythm of that sort of life, which is quite demanding. I mean, it was incredible. Mm-hmm. One has to acknowledge it was incredible, the schedule that Pope Francis kept up as Pope. Now, Pope Leo is a much younger man, but nonetheless. And let's face it, he is really, to a much greater extent than ever before in his life, he is not his own. He is not his own anymore. And so, you know, I would imagine that he was getting used to the schedule, having the meetings he needed to meet, and that he wanted to take time in order to pray and to reflect on how he should begin to implement things in the autumn, say September, October, when life gets back to normal here in Rome.
So let's have a bit of therapy.
Yes.
What were the bishops of Charlotte and Detroit doing? Was this the kind of, because on one hand, were they in the name of the forces that appointed them exercising a confident revenge on the backward pietists of Catholic faith they'd come to despise? Or knowing that their time was short because they had a new pope, a new pharaoh who didn't know them, were they just flexing their muscles for as long as they could before they wouldn't be able to do it anymore?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. Who knows? I mean, I don't know. Thanks be to the Lord. I don't know the minds and hearts of the bishops and the worldwide episcopate, but they took a great risk because.
Yeah.
They took a great risk because not knowing yet what sort of man, or maybe they had heard, maybe they had heard from perhaps other men like themselves who had a certain understanding of Cardinal Prevost, Pope Leo XIV, and thought that they could take that risk, roll the dice, and further restrict the traditional Latin Mass. On the other hand, it seems very imprudent to me if I'm in their position to take such a risk, because if you're too hard on people, they could lose their chair. I know the, people in Charlotte, it's not a good situation with the bishop there. And nobody's happy with the bishop there. And Charlotte is a very conservative diocese, both the clergy and the laity. That's always been understood. So for a bishop to come in and try to crush the traditional Mass is, at this point in the pontificate, seems to me very unwise.
And the interesting thing is, of course, that within seconds, when he just, after somebody had a word with him, he then puts out this tail between the back legs of the dog, saying, should the Vatican yes. take a different view, we will, of course, conform to it. In other words, I really overreached myself here. I've had my knuckles wrapped, and it's not going to go well in the future. That being the case, how was it that Detroit then assassinated people that he'd had in his crosshairs for a while, some really very symbolically important theologians what was he doing?
I have no idea. I don't know that bishop well, but you shall know the tree by its fruits. So there's something seriously wrong, it seems, there. I think the advantage that those professors have, which was a real scandal. I think that they are taking, from what I understand, they are taking legal action. And, again, Pope Leo, some will know that he is a canonist, studied canon law. A lot of people don't know. I was talking to a friend here in Rome, and he explained to me that Pope Leo studied canon law at the Angelicum, but at a time when the Angelicum's canon law department was quite strong, and Pope Leo's doctoral supervisor was very, very solid. So, there is the hope that whether it's the Detroit sacking of three professors or in these other cases, that the law is now going to be followed. And the law, again, matters in the church. So what's going to happen to these bishops? I would imagine one of two things. If things go as I hope they go, either they will be quietly disciplined and informed by some channel, whether by the nuncio, whether by a dicastery at the Vatican, that you'll need to get on board now. Because, the times are changing a bit. Would he remove them? I don't know. It's far, far too early to say how that would be dealt with.
So let me take you through some of the problems and ask you how you think the Pope will jump. So as far as I can see, the most obvious ones are the Vatican Bank, the dreadful position and scandal that has been proved completely intractable so far. There's the Lavender Mafia, horribly ensconced, depending on, and the extent of the horror depends upon who you read. There's the sexual scandals, the people have still not been held accountable. The church has still not purged itself of the blame by allowing some of the more obvious ones like Rupnik and there are plenty of others to hide. There's the dicasteries and the people who've been put in charge of them, and there's the Latin Mass. Take any of those or all of them.
Yes.
Which way do you see them going?
Okay. Yes. We have some of the same on our list of challenges. Although I'll present a couple of more afterwards if we have time.
Good.
The Latin Mass.
You're the professional.
On the traditional Latin Mass, also called the Vetus Ordo. As listeners may or may not know, on July 1st, I put out an article. Well, let me go back. The document that restricted the Latin Mass was called Traditionis Custodes. Pope Francis issued it in, 2021, I believe? Mm-hmm. And in that letter, so he put out the actual restrictions, and then with it an accompanying letter. And in both the decree and in the accompanying letter, he said that his decision was based on a survey that was conducted by the then Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, a worldwide survey of bishops, asking them about the implementation of Benedict XVI's Summorum Pontificum, which was the document by which Pope Benedict liberalized the traditional Mass, meaning that a priest no longer had to ask permission from the bishop or from the Vatican in order to celebrate the Mass. He could just celebrate it himself, or if a group of faithful asked him to celebrate it, he didn't need to ask for permission. So Pope Francis said that his decision to restrict the traditional Latin Mass was based upon the findings of that survey and the opinion of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And so he said to the bishops, speaking to the bishops, responding to your requests, you know, I have felt the need, you know, these results have so saddened me and shown me, you know, such a divisive situation that I feel constrained to take this action. Okay, fast forward to this year, July 1st, Feast of the Most Precious Blood in the old calendar. I had obtained two key sections of one I had already published some years ago. But then this year I obtained probably the most important section of that report, of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith's report. So its findings on...
Before we go any further, yes. You're putting this in very pedestrian and humble language. But frankly, this was one of the most important and exciting journalistic scoops of one's lifetime. I mean, I'm sure you're going to say get lost, I can't tell you. But what can you tell us about how on earth you got this material? Because it's nuclear, it's astonishing, it changes church history, the implications are beyond measurement. I mean, it's just, you know, you're the reason I'm stopping you is because I'm looking forward very much to what you're about to say factually. But just in case our listeners don't know, this was beyond huge. How did you do it?
The Lord said, ask and you shall receive. so right after Traditionis Custodes was issued, it was issued in July. And I had to give a talk at a conference, a traditional Catholic conference back in the United States. And was it September, October of that same year? And I had been going around to friends asking them, you know, what do you think I should talk about at this conference? What would be interesting? And they gave me very good ideas, but nothing really sat well with me. And in my, I'm just being very, very honest with you here and with your listeners. You know, in my heart, I thought, yes, Lord, that all sounds good. But, you know, what I really want to talk about is this survey of bishops, because this can't possibly be right. I said, please, right. Lord, please send me a section of this or send me this report. So obviously I can't talk about sources. I can't talk about sources and methods, as they say. But I obtained, it would have been the final section of the report, which was a collection of quotations taken from the survey. These quotations were from the bishops themselves. And it was a collection that the CDF put together, the last section of the report, to sort of give the Pope a representation of how the bishops were responding to the survey. So some of it was negative, but overall it was positive. Okay, so that was right after Traditionis Custodes came out. Again, you know, now we've just had the election of Pope Leo XIV, and, you know, we're in the summertime and it's getting on. And I'm like, Lord, please send me more of the survey, please. And he did. Again, I can't speak about sources and methods. But what I received or obtained was it was called the overall assessment. So the first part of this report, it was a two-part report, and I think this is just a standard structure of this kind of report. The first major part of the report is going to contain a lot of data. The second part of the report contained a summary of each continent and then what was called the overall assessment. So this was the judgment, the opinion of the Congregation for the official opinion of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And what that revealed was that contrary, I mean, it was the direct opposite of what Pope Francis had said in Traditionis Custodes and in his accompanying letter. The takeaway from the overall assessment was that the bishops as a whole thought that it would do, quote, more harm than good to make any legislative changes to Benedict XVI's Summorum Pontificum. Does that mean that there weren't any bishops that had a problem? Well, no, in fact, I mean, there were certain bishops, especially the Spanish and the Italian bishops. According to the report, the Spanish and the Italian bishops either weren't interested in the old mass or were more negative towards it. But, I mean, the overall assessment did also suggest that in some cases they questioned, I think, how familiar some of these bishops actually were with Summorum Pontificum. That is, had they even read it or had they just put it aside because they weren't really interested in the old mass. So, I mean, the great takeaway from this report was that, and this was the official report from the CDF on the survey of bishops, was that overall the majority of bishops said it would do more harm than good to make changes.
Word do we use? When are we going to get?
I know you're going with this, and you're not taking me there.
I'm not going. Okay, I'm not going. Obviously, of course, you know where I'm going with it. Well, but you see, I'm a Catholic convert. I converted because I love the Petrine ministry. I love the papacy. I love the role of St. Peter. I want the best for the Pope. It's my job, my heartfelt desire to love and to pray for the Pope. So I am having trouble finding the right word to use because one springs to mind and we step back from it out of respect. What other ones can we use?
What other ones can we use? Pope Francis did not accurately portray the findings or the opinion of the CDF. I mean, that they don't match up. The official report says this, Pope Francis said that, and the two do not match up.
Sub-transparency.
Yes, there's perhaps a lack of transparency. Now, after I put out the news about the report, and I translated from, because obviously this report would have been written in Italian. So I translated it into English and then put out both the Italian original of the overall assessment together with an English translation. Now, after that, some days after the Holy See press office was quiet. There was no response from the Vatican.
I'm quiet. I imagine they all had their heads down the toilet and were flushing away. When can I bring my head up and what on earth am I going to do? Look at what Diane Montagna has done to us. Okay, so they stop flushing. They bring their heads up. And then what do they do next?
Well, and what they do next is providentially, what day was this? Was it July 4th? It was just a few days after. I think it was the Thursday. July 1st was a Monday. I forget. In any case, it's not important. A few days later, there happened to be a press conference and this press conference, ironically enough, it was on the new mass for the care of creation. Yeah. This was important. It needed a press conference. And so,
Eco-mass.
A journalist, young journalist from Catholic News Agency, Hannah Brockhaus, she asked because it was the mass for the care of creation at the press conference. There was present on the panel an official from the Dicastery for Divine Worship. In fact, I mean, from what I've heard, he was quite involved in the whole process of Traditionis Custodes. So he's sitting on the panel. Hannah Brockhaus of CNA stands up, asks the question in Italian about, you know, there's been this article put out by Diane Montagna, and can you give us a comment about this? So Archbishop Viola, that's his name, he, of course, this was complete damage control. They obviously had met beforehand. And he sort of looks at her, and then he looks over at Matteo Bruni, and he shrugs his shoulders as though, you know, what can I say? And Matteo Bruni then reads an official statement prepared from a sheet of paper and says, you know, while I cannot confirm the authenticity of the document. He said, while I do not confirm the authenticity of the document, because of course he could have confirmed the authenticity of the document. He said, you know, this is only a partial representation, and other documents, I forget his exact words and don't want to misrepresent him, but to the effect that, you know, other documents, other surveys also formed the basis of, you know, the Pope's decision. Now, is that true? We've never heard anything about that. The Vatican has never said that. Pope Francis never said that. So we only have Pope Francis's words to go by, and in the official documents, he is telling the worldwide episcopate that it was based on their responses and the report by the CDF and their opinion. So,
well, it's a kind of euphemism, isn't it? I mean, it would include little briefing notes scribbled by one theologian to another that, you know, there's more than one document, he's saying, and you don't know what's on the ones we're not telling you about.
Yes.
So you can't be. It's intended to crumple your confidence, but we know perfectly well it's a trick. They know it's a trick. We know that they know it's a trick. Forget it. Just, you know, they've been caught
Yes, say it.
Let's not be vulgar. They've been caught anyway. Go on. Right.
So a few days later, I saw this and I thought, you know, it was Matteo Bruni. He's the Vatican spokesman. And so I thought, So I obtained the protocol number for the document. And I thought, well, if they're not going to confirm it, then I will. So a few days later, I put out the protocol number with a few other parts from the document that I had obtained in those days. Some people have commented on social media, you know, just come out with it all. Why this, you know, drip, drip, drip? Well, I am giving people what I've been receiving along the way. It's not that I'm sort of keeping the entire document in hiding and then, you know, casting out.
You're causing the bad people nervous breakdowns, because every point they say, oh my God, she knows. How much does she know? Maybe she doesn't know it all. Next one comes out. Oh my God, she knows. So, I mean,
revenge, but. So I put out my report on July 1st, and unbeknownst to me, a very respected Italian priest, Don Nicola Bux, he's a liturgist, he's a former member of both the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and the Congregation for Divine Worship, and then an Italian journalist, his name is Severio Gaeta, they had in their possession the report.
Wow.
And they were preparing to put out a book. Now, they were taking some time, you know, actually, I believe that they had intended to put this book out in March of this year. But then, of course, Pope Francis went into the hospital, and that would have just not been the suitable time to put something out like that. So they had decided to put it out in October. And then when they saw my report come out on July 1st, they're like, she's got it. So they immediately put the book out online, and they were able to provide me with the protocol number and then some other parts of the document. So, I mean, there's no doubt that what I put out is accurate. What Severio Gaeta and Don Nicola Bux put out in their own work is, you know, is so, but you know, when I did this, cause I thought people are going to say that you're trying to, you know, push Pope Leo to do something, or isn't this manipulative that she would do that? And people have said that. That's not at all what I thought. And in fact, in doing this, I thought, you know, this could be a real, well, it's obviously it's a service to the church, because people have suffered from this. You know, when Traditiones Custodes first was published, my first thoughts went to the deacons, the men, young men, who had just been ordained deacons. They had just promised celibacy. And because that's the point, whether listeners know or not, that's when you promise celibacy. And probably you'll be ordained within a year as a priest. But many of these young men who had were looking forward, and they were giving their lives and wanted to celebrate the traditional Mass and live out their priesthood in that way, with the expectation that they could. And then suddenly the hatchet comes down, and the Dicastery for Divine Worship, you know, they talk about how newly ordained priests would need to petition them, or the bishop would need to petition the dicastery on their behalf in order to celebrate the old Mass. But in fact, there were no permissions given out by the dicastery for the for divine worship to celebrate the new Mass. It was, the plan was to strangle the old Mass and eradicate it. And so, I mean, you know, so you had chiefly, you know, those young men who had just been ordained deacons or priests for that matter. You had the families. I mean, I had in Rome, I had a woman come up to me earlier this week from Texas. And she said, you know, she said, "Are you Diane Montagna?" And I said, "Yes." She said, she introduced herself. She said, "I'm from Texas." And she said, "I brought my 18-year-old daughter. She just turned 18, so I brought her to Rome." She said, and I always find this very humbling. She said, "Thank you so much for your work." She said, "It means so much to us." And she was saying this with tears in her eyes. She said, we lost our Mass in our diocese.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is affecting real families. The Dicastery for the for Divine Worship, pardon me for stumbling over my words. The Dicastery and Cardinal Roach, you know, they talk about how they were giving out permissions for 2 years for the Mass to continue, you know, until, and I think those permissions now are coming due. And that's why we're seeing these things from Detroit and Charlotte, because the permissions are coming due. And so something's got to be done. These bishops are deciding to try to crack down. But, you know, the idea was in Cardinal Roach's mind, in the Dicastery's mind, we're going to give them 2 years. And we're going to appoint a priest to tell them about the beauties and the riches of the new Mass so that eventually they will return to the new Mass. But I mean, they're so tone deaf, because what they don't realize is that you have children, you have families. The children have been baptized in the old rite. Their children are now being married in the old rite. These people have grown up with the old Mass. It's not, there is no returning for them, because they've never gone to the, or maybe on occasion, but they've never really gone consistently to the new Mass. So there's just such a tone deafness on, there has been, on the part of the
deacons. And it's not, I mean, You've painted a very moving picture, both for the deacons and also, as you quite rightly say, for the Eucharistic communities that have lost their whole way of living, praying, believing. But actually, in terms of your defence, which other people can make even if you don't, there was a cognitive dissonance around the whole church, which hurt the head and hurt the heart. We knew very well it wasn't true.
Yes.
But how can you say that without exercising a degree of disobedience and mistrust that one's duty as a Catholic didn't allow one to make? So it's almost as if, you know, almost anyone with two brain cells to rub together is living with a degree of cognitive dissonance and spiritual indigestion, waiting for the relief to come when somebody finally tells the truth. I mean, thank God that's what you did, because this lands the most awful boil and allows the process of truth-telling and healing at least to begin.
Yes.
So I've stopped you. I'm going to ask you in a moment what you think, when you think Leo might act, but do continue the story from your
point of view. Yeah, no, just to, you know, to your point, and that takes me back to... I can tend to go off on my little side paths after this flower or that flower, if you can imagine one walking in the woods. But to go back to, you know, is one of the main points I was making, you know, people might say, or people had criticized putting out the article saying, you know, you're trying to force the Pope to do something. No, not in the least. A, I have too much respect for him. But B, I do think that it helps him in a certain sense, because if I may use this language, if in the family of the church, everybody in the house knows what the truth is, it makes it much easier for him to act, because
it depoliticizes it. Yeah.
Yes. Right. And he doesn't have to look like he's
Yeah.
Going against Pope Francis. It's like everybody knows, you know, I'll leave it to the Lord to judge Pope Francis, to know why he did what he did. That's very much up to the Lord right now. Mm-hmm. And we can only pray for Pope Francis's soul that one day he may see the Lord. But I just think it's much healthier within the house of the church for everybody to know what really happened and what the truth of the situation was. And I think it makes it much easier for Pope Leo to act without looking like he's going against his predecessor.
Do you think there's any doubt at all that he won't act?
I find it very, very difficult. And this is only my own speculation. But from what I see, I think it's going to be, I find it very difficult to believe that he won't act in some way. The question is, how will he handle this? Will he simply start giving permissions to priests, and will he send a message to the bishops that you can now allow the traditional mass in parish churches, particularly in the US, but also France, England, because those were the areas most affected. Will he do something legislatively? That remains to be seen, but I have little doubt that he will do something. The question is, we don't know how he navigates things yet, and so it's hard to judge how he will act in this situation.
And I know the semiotics are complex, but and he's given all kinds of signals, quite rightly. But one of the signals from the very beginning was his comfort with Latin and liturgy.
Yes, thanks be to God, he's the first American pope. But if I may say, you know, he doesn't have an American accent.
Yes. I
think I can say that as an American. He doesn't have the typical American accent, because that would be difficult to listen to for the next 25 years. He speaks He speaks Italian beautifully. He speaks Latin beautifully. He seems very comfortable. He celebrates the mass very reverently. He seems traditionally minded and conforming himself again, you know, and conforming himself to the office, also in the way that he behaves, in the way he dresses, etc. So I...
And he sings well.
Yes, he does.
So we have some hope. I know that you have to go before long, so we don't have a lot of time,
yes,
sadly. But let me take you on. I mean, so first of all, you know, on behalf of everybody, thank you for praying in the way you did and allowing God to act. And what's happened is really utterly wonderful. So we'll wait and see what he does. Finance. I mean, the situation in the Vatican Bank is beyond awful. Undoubtedly, it played some part in the ruination of Cardinal Pell,
yeah,
as he began to get to grips with it. I mean, poor man. What's he going to do?
You know, finances, you know, some people will argue that he was elected because people realized that the Vatican was in such a terrible financial shape that they knew they needed an American to be elected in order to put it back into shape. Now, I do think that there will be more cash flowing into the Vatican now from the United States. The question is, will it come from the conservatives? Will it come from the progressives? Who will it come from? I do think that there will be more money flowing in. Again, he does seem to be a man who respects the law and processes, and he seems like an honest man to me. So I've never covered in great detail the financial problems of the Vatican. I've left that to other more able people who can wrap their heads around that sort of topic. So I'm not the best to speak about that. You know, you mentioned, Gavin, say another great challenge he's going to need to face, although I don't really think it's not difficult to do, is the abusers who were protected. Like, yeah, Rupnik is the clearest case. Now, that process is supposedly working its way through the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. Basically the same, you know, is the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith that excommunicated Rupnik in, what year was that? But that was 2020. In mm-hmm. January, a unanimous panel of judges came to the conclusion that he had excommunicated himself by the crime that he had committed. That following May, that was communicated to him. And then within a few weeks, a couple of weeks, that excommunication was lifted. So the CDF was doing its job. That was under a good Jesuit Cardinal Luis Ladaria that I think really, you know, everything I've heard about him, good theologian, very, very discreet man that was in a terribly difficult position. But I can almost guarantee it, it was not Cardinal Ladaria, the then prefect of the CDF, that lifted that excommunication by his own volition. He had to have been told to do that. So if that same process is allowed to play out without slow walking it, then Rupnik should be, what's to be done about Rupnik, but whatever action is appropriate to take will be taken, along with the other similar cases.
And there are others, a chain of names we know, yes, who were given favorable treatment and hidden in the woodwork in the last 12 years. That said,
if I may, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Gavin.
Go ahead.
There was a case that came up just in the last, 3 weeks? A case, I think it was The Pillar that reported on it, perhaps. Mm-hmm. If that's not, correct, forgive me to The Pillar. But a case of an official in the Secretary of State, an official in the Secretary of State who had been imprisoned for several years in the Vatican. Canada wanted to, and the U.S. wanted to arrest him, I think, for child pornography, accessing it when he was in Canada. And so he was brought back to the Vatican, but I think he was imprisoned here in the Vatican. And then just recently, he was given his post back, or a post, in the Secretary of State. So he is working again in the Secretary of State. And his name was even, people who knew about this, maybe inside the Secretary of State, some thought that he was just given this position, but it wasn't a real position. He was basically given some work to do because he knew how to do this work, but it was nothing official. He was just given something to do to occupy his time. Well, but in fact, his name was mentioned, written in the Anuario, which for your, it's like the phone directory for the Vatican that's issued each year. And he was listed as an official of the Secretary of State. So there is a current, very live case of somebody who was guilty of something extremely grave that was just rehabilitated. Now, did Pope Leo even know about that, or did Cardinal Parolin? Was it Cardinal Parolin who just oversaw that and decided that? We don't know that, but that's another case, very recent, that, hopefully will be dealt with.
Well, and also, I think we have to assume that for at least 12 months, there's going to be stuff working its way through the bureaucratic system that predates Pope Leo, including some episcopal appointments.
Yes.
So he's not, I don't think we can hold him responsible yet. Those kind of things will take some time to work out. Are you a subscriber to the Lavender Mafia theory and its seriousness?
Subscriber? I don't have much doubt that one exists. I don't have much doubt. That's a huge problem. That is a huge problem. How do you root something like that out of the Vatican? I think we need to pray a lot for Pope Leo, a lot. He's a compassionate man, but I think, his brothers in the initial interviews that they did with the media seemed to give the impression that their youngest brother is, or their little brother is quite clear on where he stands on those issues. So,
well, you can feel it, can't you?
Yes.
You just know.
Yes. But, to get back to, something you just said about the things that are sort of working themselves out in the first 12 months. Another, to return to something that came up earlier, the whole question of synodality, something I'd like to address. Earlier this week, or for the past week and a half, there have been stories. It first came out in the Italian media, and now it's been making its way through the English-speaking media. It's about, the headlines will go something like, Pope Leo invites pro-LGBT group to Jubilee in October, or Pope Leo to receive pro-LGBTQ group during Jubilee. Now, those are misleading to say the least. Mm-hmm. I was in touch. I'm actually writing about this, but we can go ahead and talk about it if you like. So there's a jubilee for what the story is. There's going to be a jubilee because, as listeners will know, this is the jubilee year. So there are all these different groups that come to Rome for the jubilee. Some meet with the Holy Father. They go through the holy door, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a jubilee for synodal teams that is going to be held in late October, I think the 24th to the 26th. So this is run by, the whole jubilee is run by the Dicastery for Evangelization. But because this jubilee pertains to the synod on synodality, the secretariat for the synod is assisting and organizing this jubilee. So it was initially just for these synodal teams, whatever they are. Anyway, so this story goes out that We Are Church, do you know the infamous group, the dissident group, We Are Church? They are apparently the group that is now being received in audience by Pope Leo, or that's how the stories go. Here's what happened, because I contacted the spokesman for the Synod Secretariat, asking him, you know, telling him, listen, these articles are going out. What's the truth here? And who invited this group? So as it turns out, first thing to be said is that Pope Leo did not invite this group to the Jubilee. What happened was they had, at a certain point, I don't know what motivated this, but the Synod Secretariat decided to broaden out this Jubilee of synodal teams, and they invited just individuals to register for it. I don't know if they wanted to up the numbers or what the reason was, but 8 people from We Are Church applied as individuals to come to the Jubilee. This was at the end of July. They didn't hear back. So their Irish international chair contacted the Synod Secretariat, and he said, listen, my 8 people have registered, but they haven't heard back. It's, you know, what's happening. So they received back a message from the Synod Secretariat saying, yes, you know, it is confirmed. And then to quote, it said, and on behalf of Cardinal Mario Grech, who's the prefect for the Synod Secretariat, out of esteem and appreciation in your regard, we invite you to participate in the entire Jubilee program. Now, that Jubilee program includes certain workshops, and it will also include an audience with the Pope. This will probably be a very large audience with the Pope. This isn't a private, small audience with the Pope. And then there's Mass with the Pope. So, I'm kind of giving away the story that I'm going to write about, but why not? I followed up and asked, I said, well, did Cardinal Grech personally invite them? Or was this a form letter? Because I could imagine this was a form letter that went out from the Synod Secretariat. Shall we wait for the chimes? Yes. Are we back?
They're done. Yep.
Yes. Okay. So in fact, it was a form letter. So Pope Leo definitely did not invite We Are Church to the Jubilee. Cardinal Grech actually did not personally invite We Are Church to this Jubilee. However, I think what this situation shows is that under Cardinal Grech, the Synod Secretariat has become a place where dissident groups that would have in the past dealt with the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and the doctrinal problems that they have, they are not welcome. They're being welcomed by the Synod Secretariat under its current leadership. So this, I think, is going to create a problem. Cardinal Grech, actually, you know, it occurred to me yesterday, he was one of the more progressive papal candidates. People thought, and some people wanted Hollerich, Cardinal Hollerich, who's very progressive, but they knew they couldn't get him. So they thought, we'll put Grech forward. Maybe he'll be more palatable towards people, but it'll get the whole agenda through. Well, you know, so you've got Cardinal Grech running the synod, and he seems to be much more progressive than what we've seen out of Pope Leo. And then you've got Pope Leo, who's got to navigate this whole infrastructure that's been amassed during the pontificate of Pope Francis. So there's a lot there. That's one of the challenges that I think will present itself to him.
Thank you. I mean, first of all, people will be very excited when you break the story, because you know there is, well, there are little bubbles, aren't there? I mean, we're just a small bubble of our faithful, immensely sophisticated listeners, but nonetheless, we're still a small bubble. So when this thing breaks, people will be very glad to hear it. And it's very important that we realize how the system's been gamed by the progressive groups, precisely to give the impression that they're exercising an influence that's in fact wholly disproportionate to the reality.
Well, exactly.
So it's good to know that the Pope Leo will keep clean hands on this. What's your take on the Dicasteries? Do you think he's going to go through them with a hot knife through butter? Does Tuccio keep his job, or
yeah, well, let's
can we begin to celebrate a party already? Say goodbye to him.
Well, let's begin with maybe the Dicastery for Divine Worship, Cardinal Roach.
Oh, yes, let's begin with Roach, indeed.
Yes, in Roach. Well, Roach only has, you know, under Pope Francis, I think he made curial positions. He turned them into five-year terms. So I think that Cardinal Roach only has a year left of his term.
Will, so he may just evaporate.
He may just evaporate. Pope Leo, let's just assume that Pope Leo does something about the traditional mass, which, I mean, Cardinal Roach, he's going to have a lot to answer for. You know, he just went with the winds. Under Pope Benedict, he was all about the traditional mass, or, you know, at least vocally. But then he went completely hardcore and even beyond Francis in implementing and bringing down the hatchet on the traditional mass. So will he have to preside over the undoing of what he has been doing for the past few years and then quietly be put out to pasture or given... Or would he potentially be transferred to a dicastery where he can do less harm? Those are possible. The biggest question, and you've pointed to it a couple of times, is the dicastery for the doctrine of the faith. I mean, his Cardinal Fernandez, you know, both on his theological formation and preparation. You know, many would say he's not qualified just from that perspective to be in the position that he's in, that he was put there because he was the ghostwriter for Pope Francis of both Amoris Laetitia and, well, Fiducia Supplicans. He can own that. But also that, you know, he's got the scandal of these books that he put out, you know, years ago. And, you know, he, at the time when they came out, he said, well, you know, I was 35 or something at the time. That's your excuse. You were a 35-year-old grown man and a priest.
Which is why you decided to write a book on the theological significance of the moustache in liturgical kissing. It doesn't matter how old you are.
Exactly.
That's not going to carry.
No, and 35 is not 13, you know.
No, that's right. No, it's not. No, indeed.
So I think that'll be difficult. You know, I think that La Plata, where Cardinal Fernandez came from, the diocese he came from. I could be mistaken about this, but my last understanding was that diocese is actually still open. So could Pope Leo say, you know, we can't find anyone well suited to, you know, to take care of this diocese. You know, there's just no one is compared to you. So I've got to send you back. Or, you know, but that's difficult also because, you know, we hope that something will change there. Not only because of the scandal, but also because he just doesn't seem theologically knowledgeable enough to deal with the many very important questions. Especially, you know, Pope Leo wants to do things about, even this might not immediately come to mind, but AI questions regarding the modern world. There are deep theological and anthropological questions that the Catholic Church needs to speak to today. And the Pope needs qualified men who know their stuff and are able to communicate that. So
AI is going to require the sharpest brains the Church has to offer. And
so,
Tuccio, God bless him, isn't one of
them. Isn't one of them. He's not one of them. So yes, hopefully that will change. But again, you know, after the past 12 years under Pope Francis's pontificate, a whole system has been put in place in the Vatican. So, and it's not just a matter of Pope Leo appointing one head of new dicastery, another head of another dicastery. That would be a good start. But there is a whole infrastructure and the people underneath that he needs competent, smart, competent people of good experience to be able to run things. So it's no
wonder he went away. No wonder he went away to take a break.
Yes.
Before coming back for the autumn. You were going to say something about, maybe we should end on this. You were going to say something about his break in Castle Gandolfo.
Oh no, I don't. I just think it's terribly. I think it's a wonderful sign of a healthy person who wants to get away during the summertime and spend time out of Rome and out of the Vatican. And I just think, and you know, we should say also mention that he is to return to the Apostolic Palace apparently at the end of August, perhaps. They've been renovating it. There have been some reports out that, and this would break with tradition a bit, but not necessarily in a bad way. You know, he is an Augustinian and he's used to living in community as a religious, although he was a bishop in Peru. I don't know what his situation was there in terms of how he lived, but you know, it appears that they've been renovating the Apostolic Palace so that he would live together with a small community of Augustinians, which could be very healthy.
Yes, I'm hoping to write something about that in a few days' time. And as you say, it's a new model, but it brings the best elements of earlier models together. And again, it's just a very way of different doing things. Very different way of doing things, and for different reasons than his predecessor, whose stay in Hotel Marta, what was it called?
Santa Marta.
Santa Marta was portrayed as an exercise of profound humility, but was undoubtedly part of the exercise of realpolitik and the picking up of information and politicization and. To have a fraternal community for the Pope to live amongst makes every kind of sense.
Yes,
theologically, liturgically, psychologically, spiritually.
Yes,
and to have I remember hearing somebody say, I think they wrote a postcard to the Pope saying that the light has been out in the Vatican apartments for 12 years, and you can't know how important it is for us at nighttime to see a light in that window and to know that the Holy Father is present and there. So there are all kinds of small ways in which the restitution of authentic Catholicism is being promised and will be acted out.
Yeah. May I add just one other area very briefly where I think we're seeing a change and a sign of hope? Earlier this week, this is another article I'm writing, but the Pope sent a telegram to a group in the Amazon, the bishops of the Amazon were meeting early in the past days for 3 days. And it was the first time that they were meeting together since the infamous Amazonian Synod, which people came to be remembered for the Pachamama. And we all remember that time. And the Pope sent a telegram to them as they were meeting. So, you know, and keep in mind this Mass for the Care of Creation, which I mentioned earlier, Pope Leo did celebrate that somewhat privately. It got some press at Castel Gandolfo this summer. So he did celebrate that Mass, and probably progressives would have seen that as a sign that, getting back to your original point, Gavin, that yes, he's one of ours. So he did celebrate that Mass, but then in this telegram, he stressed to the bishops who were meeting together, you know, that he said, if I can quote, he said, "It is necessary that Jesus Christ, in whom all things are recapitulated," citing Ephesians, "be announced with clarity and immense charity among the inhabitants of the Amazon, so that we may strive to give them fresh and pure the bread of the good news and the heavenly food of the Eucharist, the only means to truly be the people of God and the body of Christ." And then he says, "In this mission, we're moved by the certainty, confirmed by the history of the Church, that wherever the name of Christ is preached, injustice receives proportionality." And then regarding, for those who are concerned about the climate craziness, he says, "Within this perennial doctrine," when's the last time we've heard the term perennial doctrine? "Within this perennial doctrine, no less evident is the right and duty to care for the home that God the Father has entrusted to us as diligent stewards, so that no one irresponsibly destroys the natural goods that speak of the goodness and beauty of the Creator, nor much less subjects oneself to them as a slave or worshiper of nature, since things have been given to us in order to attain our end of praising God and thus obtaining the salvation of our souls. This is what he sent to the bishops of the Amazon. He is, even the way he speaks, and Benedict spoke of the care for creation, but it's all put within a supernatural context and our final end. It's beautiful.
Absolutely. It's eschatologically driven. It's theologically balanced. The priorities are exactly yes. the way they should be. As you say, it's beautiful. And it's the right ordering of everything. You can bring in a creation. Indeed, you have to bring in creation. But it must be done in precisely the right, you know, the right, not chronological, thematic way that he did. So that's fantastic. What an incredible piece of writing. And as you say, it just brings a great deal of joy and relief to the heart, where, you know, Pachamama can never happen again, thank God.
No, exactly. So these are some of the reasons. I mean, these are some of the things that have been happening here in Rome that people might be a little bit less aware of. So I do think that, I mean, I tend to be an optimist just by temperament, but I do think that these are all small but genuine signs that we can be at least cautiously optimistic.
Well, I think there's congruency between your temperament and the times we live in. So I agree. And I mean, you know, what a relief to be alive at a time like this, as they said just before the French Revolution, where thank God we've seen the appointment of a Catholic Pope, how blessed we are. Diane, thank you so much for taking this time and trouble and bringing your range of expertise and also the terribly exciting story of the uncovery of that scoop, yes. which I think many of us will just sit up on a cold and dark night from time to time and hug ourselves with joy over, particularly as we remember the way in which the authorities tried to deal with it. But we're very grateful. Thank you so much. And I know that all our listeners will be enormously happy to have been able to share in your perceptions and your judgments. And thank you for your writing and all you do.
Thank you, Gavin. Thank you.